God said very simply, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And I believe that it goes without stating that the word "before me" means beside me, under me, around me, or anywhere near me. Thou shalt have no other gods. Man has the tendency to worship gods with teachings and with faults like his own. As you go down through history and you look at the mythology of the various civilizations, as you look at the different gods that the peoples of this world have worshipped, you will find that the gods did things and commanded things that the people enjoyed. People enjoyed worshiping Bacchus, who was the god of the wine, the god of the grape. It was quite fun to have a festival under Bacchus, or to have a god such as Pan or Ashtaroth, or a god that was very much set on allowing you as his worshiper to indulge in all kinds of physical pleasures. And man has always done this. If man is given to the opportunity of devising a god that he will worship, it will be one that is very much following his own lustful pleasures. We live in a civilization today where we don't see gods set up on every corner. We don't see the little prayer stalls where as you go by, you stop and say a prayer to some god that you might have good fortune today in your business sessions or in your common way of life. We don't really have too many what we would class idols in the United States. But we certainly have various gods that we all worship. And this evening we'd like to consider these as to how they infringe upon the worship of the one true God, and how many times we do find that there are things and people and places that take precedence over this first commandment when God told Israel, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." In Colossians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul wrote concerning this, 3 and verse 1 through 5, we read these words, "If thou be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry." Here we come to the idea that we can have other gods before the one true God, and basic among this, the Apostle Paul says, is covetousness, which is idolatry. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, as God is speaking about these commandments, he said that we are not to covet our neighbor's anything, whether it's his wife, his cattle, his oxen, his sheep, his goats, or whatever, we are not to covet. So we find out that this commandment and the first commandment of "thou shalt have no other gods before me" are very closely intertwined. This covers the material world, the physical world, and I believe it even covers the mental world. One of the problems that we find in many churches today is that we tend to lose our identity. We refuse to look upon ourselves as an individual group of members of the body of Christ. And we refuse to admit that we are unique, that we are different from any other group in the world. And I believe that many times we can mimic other people. And in so doing, we can lose our identity. They say that children go through a stage in life when they are very much prone to hero worship, where they will pick out some baseball star, some boxing idol, or usually someone in the sporting field or someone in the rock field now, and they will pattern their lives after that person. And if it goes far enough, we find that they not only wear their hair and their clothes like this person, but they, in a way, take on the identity of that person, and they lose their own individual personality. churches have done the same. And I feel that in many respects, we are doing the same, and we are allowing this to become a god to us. We can look around at other churches, and we can see that, well, they have programs, they have teachings, they have ways that makes them a successful people. And if we can just do what they are doing, we can be just as successful as them. And in doing this, we forget about the commandment of God where he said, I'm going to be with you. I will be your God. I will be your help. I will be your stay. And we say, no, if we pattern ourselves after this church over there, if we change our constitution to look like their constitution, and if we have our services like their services, and if we do this like they are doing that, well, then we can also be a successful people. You see, this is what Israel did. They came into the land, and they had made an agreement with God. God said, you are not to have any other gods before me. And Israel said, we are going to abide by that. You are our only God. And then they came into the land, and they had some dealings with the Canaanites and the various people that were already in the land. It's a very possibility, a very good possibility, that they might have had a little bit of trouble with their farming, that the land wasn't producing exactly like it should have been, because maybe they were farming it like you farmed in Goshen and not the way that you farm in Canaan. And so one of these days, one of their Canaanite neighbors came over to the Israelites' land and said, well, you know, if you would pray to Baal, you might have better crops. And then he might talk to him about a little bit about how great Baal was. And as he was starting to leave, he might have said, oh, by the way, instead of planting those seeds 6 inches deep, plant them 10 inches deep. So when the harvest came, and he had a better harvest than he ever had before, the Israelitish man said, well, you know, these prayers to Baal really helped. He didn't realize that he had changed his planting procedure. All he'd remembered was that he had prayed to the Baal of the Canaanites. Well, I don't know if that's exactly the way it happened, but you know, it's a very good possibility. And I believe that it happens to us many times. This became such a problem in the days of the prophet Elijah that Elijah had to meet with the prophets of Baal to get the people to do something that had already been done for them. They'd already said on one occasion, we are going to serve God and have no other gods before him. But Elijah had to stand in front of them and say, choose you this day whom you are going to serve. You either serve Baal or you serve the one true God. And we are very familiar with the account that's given to us in the book of Kings as to how Elijah and the prophets of Baal met for a little confrontation to see which God would send the fire down to burn the sacrifice. And Elijah, during the time when the prophets of Baal were praying and cutting themselves, he showed very poor sportsmanship. Because Elijah stood on the sidelines and he said, maybe you better yell a little louder, because maybe Baal is taking a nap. Or maybe Baal is taking a journey. You know, we should never do things like that. Well, that's unsportsmanlike. That's just a terrible thing to do. But Elijah did it. And evidently God didn't care, because when it came time for Elijah to call for upon his God for his power, we are told that the fire did come down from heaven, consumed not only the sacrifice, but also the 12 barrels of water that had been poured upon the sacrifice. Also destroyed the altar upon which the sacrifice was placed. All of this happened, I believe, because Elijah remembered this first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. We serve the one true God. And Jesus said, and this is life eternal, that we might know the one true God and Jesus Christ whom he has sent. I believe that we are living in a country and in a land and in a time when we are a vast minority, because we believe in the one true God. We can never in any way minimize this doctrine, and neither should we in any way compromise this doctrine. We worship the one true God, the God of Israel, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and He's also going to be the Father of the new age in which we intend to live. Jesus talked about the oneness of God and about the worship of this God, I think in a very graphic manner, at the very beginning of His public ministry. In Matthew, the 3rd chapter, we are told that Jesus was baptized of John in the River Jordan. And in chapter 4, we are told that He was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, and there Jesus was tempted. And so in Matthew chapter 4, in the first few verses, we are told about the temptation of Jesus. The first two temptations are given to us in verses 3 through 7. And then the tempter came to Him and said, "If thou be the Son of God." And I want you to pay close attention, because we hear a great deal of this today. If you are really a child of God, you wouldn't be suffering these problems. If you are really God's people, you would have a bigger church. If, you know, all this is very good at putting doubt in a person's mind. If you are the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. But He answered and said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God." Then the devil taketh Him up into the holy city, and setteth Him on the pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto Him, "If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, He shall give His angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou shalt dash thy foot against a stone." And Jesus said unto him, "It is written, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." The first two temptations of Jesus were for selfish ends. Jesus made wine simply for people who were not necessarily thirsty, but He made wine for a wedding feast, that a party might not be spoiled. If Jesus could make wine for a wedding party, why couldn't He make bread for Himself after He had been fasting for 40 days and 40 nights? Jesus had 5,000 people gathered along the seashore. He fed them with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. If He did that for these 5,000 who were careless enough to go out without providing for their own personal needs, why couldn't He provide for Himself stones into bread that He might be fed? It was not the idea of making bread, but it was the purpose behind it. It was to prove that I am the Son of God. And Jesus did not need to prove that He was the Son of God. Both of these miracles in Matthew chapter 4 had selfish ends. But then we had the third temptation of Jesus, as it's mentioned in verses 8 and 9. "Again the devil taketh Him up into an exceeding high mountain, and showed Him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them, and said unto Him, All these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship Me." I've often wondered what went through the mind of Christ at this time. What did Jesus see? Maybe He saw a new Rolls Royce. He saw a condominium out here on Myrtle Beach. You know, I wonder what He saw. That all of these can be yours if you will fall down and worship Me. Jesus did the same thing with this that He did with the prior two temptations. He simply made a quotation from the Old Testament. Look at Matthew chapter 4, verse 10. "Then said Jesus unto him, Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and Him only shalt thou serve. Thou shalt have no other gods before Me." The offer in all three temptations was rejected by an Old Testament quotation. And I think that what Jesus did here is an example for us throughout our lifetimes. And that was that he based his decision upon the written expression of God's will, rather than upon some logical argument. Jesus could have said, you know, it's promised in the scriptures that I'm going to have the whole earth to reign over. Why, Jesus knew the Old Testament. He could have gone back and he could have said, it's promised that I'm going to be the branch. I'm going to rule. I'm going to sit upon the throne of David. And logically, Jesus said, why can't I do it this way? Because you see, what God had offered was the cross. The temptation was to bow down and to worship something else. But Jesus says, no. Here is God's will that he has expressed in his word. And so therefore, he did not go by a logical argument, but he went by God's written word. He rejected not only the offer, but he rejected the condition of this offer, because it infringed upon God's exclusive right of worship. In Mark, the 12th chapter, verses 28 through 30, we have a man that came to Jesus in Jesus' last part of his ministry. This is probably one of the men that came trying to trap Jesus into saying something wrong. And he said, one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord with all thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. And this is the first commandment. I think this is interesting, because Jesus did not give him necessarily the first commandment of the ten, but he gave him the first commandment in importance, because Jesus did not go to the 20th chapter of Exodus, where we had the Ten Commandments, but Jesus went to the Shema of Israel. The comment that was made by the Israelites day after day, which was very well known, from Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Jesus says that is the first thing to remember. That is the first in importance. And in knowing this, you shall serve this God and keep this God above all else. I believe that the first commandment that God gave is the one commandment upon which all the others hang. And that is that we must know that our God is supreme, that he is the one true God, and he deserves and he demands our undivided worship, respect, and also commitment. I believe that sometimes the second commandment, which is given in Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6, are sometimes, well, this commandment is, I think, very often confused with the first commandment. It is true they're similar, but they are not the same. The first one is that thou shalt have no other gods before me. The second commandment is thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not make any graven image unto our God. I believe that the second commandment deals more with the problem of falsely worshiping the one true God than the worship of false gods. We mentioned a moment ago that oftentimes images were made, but images were made to represent something else. Even though people made a Baal or an idol, they weren't dumb enough to think that that piece of wood or that piece of steel was the entire God, because they were all over town. And so it is that people were worshiping something behind or something beyond the actual image that they were looking at. And this is what God told the Israelites that he did not want. He said, you are not to make any image of me, or that you can worship me through, of anything that's on the land, in the sea, or in the air. I just will not have you to do it. The reason for this is very simple. It's because that the images that are used to represent God, oftentimes they become what is actually worshipped. They minimize the greatness of our God if we say that this is what we are worshipping. Dr. Bullinger, in his book on the two natures in the child of God, I think he maybe goes to an extreme, but he has a very good point in there about the way that we worship, the carnal and the spiritual, as they are related to each other. And he says that anything that appeals to the flesh is carnal and should be done away with, that it is not right. I find that hard to take completely, but I think that there has to be a breaking point there where he is saying something that is right. Oftentimes, things are done in worship to God that are not worship to God. We are simply fulfilling the desires of the flesh. I appreciate the music that we've had here because of the way that it's done, because of the words, and because of the intent. But I have also heard music that's been given in a church for the purpose of glorifying God, and I went away with the feeling that the only reason that people had that music presented was that they either might tap their foot or clap at the end of it because in some way their senses were gratified. To me, this is something that borders on idolatry. Why do we have various things in a church? Do we have them because they augment our worship? Or do we have them because we feel that, you know, this is something that we must do in order that we can feel proud about being in the church? It can be a very difficult thing to define, but pictures, statues, physical representations of spiritual reality, it can only downgrade the reality that we have. And we begin to limit it to a picture or to a place. Images were very definitely forbidden. I think there are several examples in the scriptures that explain why this was done. Remember that when the people of Israel were leaving the land of Egypt, that they began to murmur because they weren't satisfied with the way that God was taking care of them. And so God sent among them the fiery serpents. When they were bitten by a serpent, they would die. And so the people came to Moses and they said, intercede on our behalf. Go to God and tell him that we're sorry, we want to repent, we'll turn around, but take care of us. And so Moses spoke to God, and God had him to build a serpent upon a pole made of brass. When they were bitten and they looked upon the serpent, they would live. We're not told much about this serpent until the days of Kings. And in the days of the kings, King Josiah decided to do away with this serpent, to finally destroy it. This fine artifact from the past, probably one of the only of the three things that were left from the wilderness wanderings, he decided to destroy that thing. And why? Because the people of Israel were starting to worship it. It took the place of the worship of the one true God. And God said, I'm not going to have that. We have, I think, similar current idolatries today. And that's making a God, or making our God, a God that you can control. Giving him a personality that we would like to see in our God. A God that is all love. That's not going to destroy anybody. That's not the one true God of the Scriptures. A God that is all so forgiving that he never disciplines his children. And he never demands anything from them. That borders on idolatry. Because it's making a God that we can control. In Luke, the 18th chapter, Jesus gave a very short parable. Luke chapter 18, verses 10 through 14. He speaks of two men that went into the temple to pray. Luke 18, beginning with verse 10. Two men went up to the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee, the other a publican. And the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I'm not as other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes into heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Not a thing in these two verses about idolatry or false gods. Except that the Pharisee said, Lord, you have to look upon me favorably because I fast twice a week. Why, not only do I fast, but I do it where everybody can see it. I make sure that people know that I'm religious. I fast twice a week. And when the offering plate comes by, I faithfully tithe. And just so that everybody will know it, I put it all in pennies. But you see, Lord, you have to be good to me because I'm a good man. Fasting is good. Tithing is good. But when it comes to the place in your life that fasting takes the place of God, and tithing gives you the opportunity to demand things of God because of what you have done, I believe that fasting and tithing or anything else becomes a false god in your eyes because you are making a god that is being bent to your wishes instead of you bending to God's wishes. I believe that Jesus interpreted the first commandment in John, or the second commandment in John chapter 4, in verses about 7 through 10. In John chapter 4, Jesus is at the well in Samaria. And this woman came to draw water while the disciples had gone into town. And we are told that Jesus spoke to this woman. He did the unpardonable. Number one, he was a Jew and he spoke to a Samaritan. And number two, he was a man and he spoke to a woman openly. Well, they began to talk at this well. They had this little conversation going back and forth. And we are told that Jesus said, "Give me to drink." In verse 9, the woman of Samaria said unto him, "How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealing with the Samaritans." And Jesus said unto her, "If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith unto thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldst have asked of him, and he would have given of thee living water." Jesus turned his request for water into an invitation for the woman. He gave her the opportunity to have something that she could not have had any other way. And I believe that the rest of this story is rather interesting because right away the woman began to say, "You don't have anything to draw with." And the conversation kept going back and forth until finally Jesus said, "Well, I know a great deal about you, lady. You've been married several times. And the man that you're living with is not your real husband." And she said, "Aha, you're a prophet." And right away, after Jesus had gotten into a personal conversation with her, and she found out that he was a prophet, she says, "Where should we worship? In this mountain in Samaria or in Jerusalem?" I found this to be true, that when people find out that you are a minister or have been a minister or are a minister's wife, you cease to be a real person. Their attitudes change toward you. You're different. That's what happened with Jesus. He was no longer a man asking her for water and carrying on a conversation, but now he was a prophet, and he made her uncomfortable. And so immediately, when she became uncomfortable, she started talking about something theological. Not personal, but where do we worship? Samaria or down in Jerusalem? We have a man at the back gate at the place where I work, one of the inmates. He played professional football in Canada until he got hurt, and that's what got him into trouble. He got a money settlement, and he went all haywire. But he's big, he's black, and he's kind of nice. One of the men I used to work with on a different farm worked the back gate the other night, and he told him that I used to be a pastor. I don't tell people that at the prison. But he told him that I used to be a pastor. And now when I go out and work at the back gate, Johnny Weekly walks up and down the gate. He sings religious songs. His whole attitude and demeanor has changed. Very similar to this woman. Where do we worship? The Jews say we worship in Jerusalem. The Samaritans say that we worship on our mountain. Look at verses 19 through 24. For he said, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. For God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. God was explained by Jesus in this way. He said, God is not limited to one time or to one place. You see, the Jews had the feeling, we have God down in Jerusalem, and we go to Jerusalem to worship, and that's where God is. And Jesus said, Woman, the Jews have one thing up on you. They do worship the one true God. That's to their credit. And they know what they worship. I would like for the same thing to be said about the Church of God, that we are worshiping the one true God, and we know what we worship. And I believe that we can truly say that salvation is of the Church of God today, if we will utilize the power that's given to us. But with all of this going for them, the Jews were saying, we have God in Jerusalem. You see, they were saying that God is ours. And they should have been saying, we are God's. And we can fall into the same trap. We are the Church of God, and God is our God. Really, we should be saying, we are the Church of God, and we are God's people. We belong to Him. He does not belong to us. He is not limited to any one time or place, but He is an all-inclusive God, and He is all-powerful, and He expects us to do His work, and we shouldn't expect Him to do our work. The nature of true worship. Sunday morning in church is not the worship experience of the week. I believe that we worship the one true God all week long, wherever we are, in whatever way that we can. But I believe that we are very close to having to follow the commandments that God gave the people of Israel. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. You don't worship gods of chrome and fiberglass and steel and mortar. You don't worship these. You worship the one true God. And he says, and you don't worship me in a false way. But you are going to worship as my son said. You are going to worship in spirit and in truth. So many people today worship just like the Samaritans. They worship, they know not what. But we know what we worship. We worship the one true God. And salvation is of his son, Jesus the Christ.